This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Why has the Middle East been such a mess for so long?
Well, there are lots of reasons why the region is unstable. The most important, which is that the countries themselves are not natural countries in terms of aligning towards ethnic, tribal, religious lines, so that they have a lot of internal incohesion to them. Almost all of these countries are fundamentally non-democratic, which in the short term sometimes might have some advantages when it comes to stability, but over the longer term is inherently unstable. If I was going to put my finger on the single most important factor that explains the largest number of actions that are taking place in the region today, it is the widespread perception of American withdrawal. Our diplomatic presence is second to none, our intelligence efforts, our economic engagement. But this perception remains, and the perception is not without merit. And if you're a country in the region whose security architecture has depended for many decades on the United States, are you going to depend on that in the immediate future? Of course. But looking ahead 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, these countries are not going to bet the existence of their country on the United States staying the course as it has.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Will Wexler is the Director of Middle East Programs at the Atlantic Council, a leading think tank in Washington, D.C. Will has served in government positions at various times in his career. Most recently, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. Will and I just sat down and talked about the state of the Middle East and how Washington should think about approaching the volatile region. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters. Will, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael. I really appreciate it.
I guess I should mention that I am on the board of the Atlantic Council, which is where you currently serve. You know, just full transparency here to my listeners. I think just think that's important. Will, this episode is part of a series of episodes that we're doing between now and the inauguration on the key national security issues that are facing our nation and that the next president will face, President-elect Biden. We started the conversation with H.R. McMaster, who gave us a kind of an overview of what's going on in the world. And we've now done episodes on both China and North Korea. And today with you, we turn to the Middle East. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Well, let me start by asking you to explain to my listeners why the Middle East is still important to the United States, even though we are now, as a nation, energy independent. Why should we still care about this place?
Sure. U.S. policies change, presidents change, but our interests remain stable, or at least long-lasting until there are deep changes. One of those deep changes that has happened is that the United States, thanks to a fracking revolution, has become an exporter of oil instead of an importer of oil. And that's a real change, and that has important implications. However, that change can be overstated as well. What it really does mean is that in the absolute worst scenarios, nobody can do to us what we did to Japan before World War II, which is cut off our source of energy in context of a war. If worse comes to worse, we can go to autarky. We can produce the energy that we need, at least the oil that we need, in the United States. And that's a really good thing. But that doesn't mean that the United States is isolated from the world. And it doesn't mean that the price of oil and energy and gas in the world doesn't affect the United States. And the reality is that price is a global price. And that price is not just dependent on U.S. production. U.S. energy producers do not give Americans a discount for being Americans. American consumers do not pay more for gas when it's produced in the United States. This is a global market. And the reality is that a very significant proportion of all of that energy still comes out of the Middle East. And because of the nature of the sources of energy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia in particular still is the swing producer and has very disproportionate impact on those global energy prices. And we saw that recently when, because of a dispute between Saudi Arabia and Russia, the Saudi Arabia decided to push energy prices into negative territory, something never seen before.
Right, right.
Thus demonstrating their clout and their power in the world. These are realities in the world and realities that that United States policies have to take account for.
So, Will, are there other reasons why the Middle East is important? One of our key allies, Israel, sits right in the middle of it. Sources of extremism, refugees, or are there other reasons why we need to pay attention?
Absolutely. The counterterrorism challenges that we all face are at a low ebb at the moment, but we've seen them be at the low ebb previously, and we've seen them get much larger and more powerful and more directly threatening before. And there's no reason to expect that can't happen again. We have a real concern about the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons in this region, especially Iranian nuclear weapons. We have a real concern about Israel. Israel is more secure and more prosperous than it's ever been before, but that doesn't mean that there are no threats to Israel anymore, and a lot of which come from Iran and its proxies. We generally, and for ever since really the Eisenhower administration, have acted as a status quo power, trying to return the region to the status quo when it's been upset, in order to build a foundation for general security and general prosperity in the region, because we believe that overall serves U.S. interests. So we have a variety of those interests which aren't going away. And despite the very popular view out there that in the American public. That's also expressed by people on both sides of the aisle in the Congress, and almost everyone that was running for president, that the United States should do less in that part of the world. That doesn't mean that we should be doing nothing in that part of the world.
And do you find yourself more and more having to explain why the region is still important?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and very understandable reasons for that. I mean, for the last 20 years, I mean, starting with George W. Bush's war in Iraq, the United States really changed its policy that it had been following for roughly five decades before that. And instead of supporting the status quo, became one of the most important threats to the status quo. And then on top of that, the failures and mistakes in the implementation of that policy, you know, has led a lot of people in the region and a lot of Americans to ask, you know, why are we still in this part of the world? You know, why should we be spending our treasure? Why should we be having, you know, U.S. soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, you know, die for this part of the world? What's really in it for us? The president of the United States, you know, President Trump, says this repeatedly. Even when probably at the high point of his administration, at least in this part of the world, when he was announcing the recent Abraham Accords between the United States and the United Arab Emirates from the Oval Office, he couldn't control himself. He went off script and said, I don't know why we have any of our forces there protecting the energy resources anymore.
Right. Yeah. So, Will, big picture. Why has the Middle East been such a mess for so long? What are the big dynamics that are at play here that have led to the continuing instability that we've seen for such a very long time?
Well, there are lots of reasons why the region is unstable. The most important, which is that the countries themselves are not natural countries in terms of aligning towards ethnic, tribal, religious lines, so that they have a lot of internal incohesion to them. They are relatively, many of them are relatively new countries. Many of them are, of course, have not too distant colonial pasts where there were lots of dysfunctions that were built into the colonial architecture that was created. The lines were drawn by European powers and the minority groups were promoted by those colonial powers intentionally. That is still a destabilizing factor. And then, of course, many of these countries are in fact, almost all these countries are fundamentally non-democratic, which in the short term sometimes might have some advantages when it comes to stability, but over the longer term is inherently unstable.
And there seems to be a long-term struggle with governance here in many of the countries in the region.
Indeed. Many of the leaders did not, for many decades, actually did not see their chief objective as improving the well-being of their populations. That's changed in some of the countries in the region, and it will have to change if the region is going to become less stable over time. But when you look at the poor economic growth, when you look at the very high demographic growth, what you see is a region that has a lot of challenges ahead of it. There are very few things that are true for every country in the world, but one of those is that the most dangerous people in any society are young men. You know, testosterone is a hell of a drug. And there are lots of young men in this part of the world that don't have avenues to channel their, you know, innate aggression into productive, constructive forms. And so they are attracted to destructive avenues.
And then how important is the strategic competition between, you know, Iran and its Sunni rivals with regard to stability in the region?
It's very important right now. You know, if I can take one step back, I believe that today and actually for the last 5 to 10 years or so, there are a lot of different factors that are affecting trends in the region. Lots of different micro factors that affect individual countries, lots of local rivalries. But if I was going to put my finger on the single most important factor that explains the largest number of actions that are taking place in the region today, it is the widespread perception of American withdrawal, American withdrawal. Now, the reality is that, unless you compare it to the high points of our occupation of Iraq, or Afghanistan, in which case, of course, the numbers of troops have gone down from then. But if you compare it more historically, the United States really hasn't withdrawn. We still have a lot of military forces there. Our diplomatic presence is second to none. Our intelligence efforts, our economic engagement. But this perception remains, and the perception is not without merit. The perception comes from actions that a consecutive U.S. presidents have taken. It comes from the rhetoric that one hears from the United States. And if you're a country in the region whose security architecture has depended for many decades on the United States, are you going to depend on that in the immediate future? Of course. But looking ahead 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, these countries are not going to bet the existence of their country on the United States staying the course as it has. They already experienced this. They're, in some cases, their fathers to a person experienced this when the British left in the early 70s after promising that they would not leave. And so this widespread perception exists, and that perception itself is creating a vacuum that other actors are moving into. China is moving in economically, politically to a degree, but not yet from a geostrategic point of view. China is in fact very actively not trying to take the United States position. They would much rather free ride off of our security guarantees for as long as possible. But they're an important actor to note. But aside from them, there are three other non-Arab powers that all have historical legacy aspirations in the region and have all been moving very actively, very aggressively into the region. And those, of course, are Iran and Turkey and Russia, all of whom have advanced their position quite significantly and materially in the last number of years. Now, if you look back historically, when any of those actors have tried to move into this region, they've had to confront the historic Arab powers in the region. Those powers in Cairo, in Damascus, in Baghdad. The leaders in those cities were the ones that had the ear of the Arab street. They had the armies. They had had disproportionate power, not only in their countries, of course, but around the region. All of those places are at very weak moments in time right now. Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad are unfortunately each closer to being a failed state than they are to being regional leaders. The historical European powers with interests in the region are similarly either not capable or not willing largely to play any types of roles with the exception of France. But even France is limited in what it can do and wants to do, mainly to Lebanon and to some degree in North Africa. And so what's left? What's left is a coalition that should have emerged a while ago, but for a number of reasons didn't, but is finally emerging now between states, Israel and the Gulf, that have largely been interested in their own defense, but not been larger regional players. And they are coming together now to position themselves to be able to protect the region against massive encroachment from these non-Arab powers. And quite frankly, that's a good thing because a region that ends up being dominated by Iran or Turkey or Russia is not a region that serves U.S. interests.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Will.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, Will, what I'd love to do now is kind of throw out some specific issues and get you to react to them and talk about how you think the United States should approach these issues. Okay. So let's start with one that we've mentioned several times already, which is Iran and its nuclear program, its regional ambitions, its malign behavior. How would you think about a strategy of dealing with the Iranians?
I think the American strategy of dealing with the Iranians has to look really hard and learn the correct lessons from both the Obama administration and the Trump administration. In my view, the Obama administration was absolutely right to consider diplomacy with Iran on its nuclear program. The results of that diplomacy contributed indisputably to positive outcomes on the nuclear file. But there were some weaknesses with that approach. And one of the key weaknesses was a division between the United States and its traditional friends and partners in the region, in particular Israel and the Gulf partners. For a sustained approach to diplomacy has to bring those partners along with it rather than be perceived to be cutting them out. The Trump administration, of course, took a very different approach to this, a maximum pressure approach to Iran, and of course, you know, got out of the nuclear deal formally, which I think was a mistake. I don't think it was a mistake to add sanctions on Iran at all. In fact, the nuclear deal very specifically allowed for such sanctions to be increased on Iran as long as those sanctions weren't on the nuclear file. And unfortunately, Iran has a lot of other malign behavior in the region that merit sanctions. But the Trump administration decided to go a different path. The big strategic problem with the Trump administration's approach was that internally, it never really came to a conclusion about what the purpose of its maximum pressure campaign was. At the outset, there were groups in the Trump administration, some groups that just wanted to increase sanctions in order to make it more difficult for Iran to conduct its malign behaviors. There was other groups in the administration that, and I include, by the way, the president of the United States in this group, that that wanted to increase sanctions in order to get to a quote-unquote better negotiated outcome. And there was other groups that really saw this as an opportunity to promote regime change. And unfortunately, the devil is in the details, and the way one goes about constructing a sanctions regime differs depending on which outcome you desire. The way that the sanction regime was constructed appears to be most in line with the people who wanted regime change, and not in line with people who wanted to facilitate additional negotiations. What I think we should do now is what I hope an incoming Biden administration does is opens the door for diplomacy. but uses the leverage that that the Trump administration gives it with the existing sanctions to try to drive a hard bargain that would bring our partners along with it. And our partners in the region, again, the Arab countries on the western side of the Persian Gulf, and Israel, you know, they only 1 year ago, they all sent emissaries rushing to Washington because they were terrified that the maximum pressure campaign was driving them in a direction of a regional war with them on the front lines. They want to de-escalate as well. So I hope the goal is de-escalation. I hope the goal is confidence-building measures. I'm a little skeptical, quite frankly, about whether or not a new nuclear agreement can be reached. I think that Iran has turned much more hardline in the interim. Windows of opportunity open and close for such things. I hope I'm wrong on that, but I don't see a downside in trying.
Will, second issue, extremism, in particular, ISIS in Syria and Iraq and Al-Qaeda in Syria, what should the U.S. role be here?
You know, Salafi jihadist terrorist groups are different from other kinds of terrorist groups, are different from other kind of Islamic terrorist groups, or they're different from other kinds of Sunni Islamic terrorist groups. What we find where of terrorist organizations that have this particular kind of ideology, wherever they are able to achieve a degree of physical sanctuary where they believe that they can act with impunity, they have a 100% record of doing external attacks. And that's just a sad reality. So our goal should be to deny them that kind of sanctuary. The United States has tried a lot of different approaches to achieving that goal. We've tried invading and occupying countries. We've tried dropping hellfires from the sky to take out high-value targets. And what we've learned is that the most effective way of combating these kinds of terrorist adversaries is indirectly, is working by, with, and through the local actors who can themselves conduct these kinds of counterterrorism missions. Sometimes these are through military channels. Sometimes these are through intelligence channels. Sometimes these are through law enforcement channels. Sometimes that that effort involves the United States doing nothing more than passing information and allowing our friends and partners to take action. But sometimes it takes more. Sometimes it takes efforts to equip these partners, to train these partners, to advise these partners, to assist them in what they do, and sometimes even to accompany them on their missions. All of these are different fundamentally than direct action, where the United States has to do it on its own and has to do the finish against these terrorist actors. What I hope is that the United States doesn't look at the world as it is today, where Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have, thanks to great work that people like you, Michael, were doing for quite a long period of time, has been diminished. And imagine that that current state will be the state in the future. It's as long as there are underlying Sunni grievances in so many of these places, we will find young men who will be attracted to this Salafi jihadist ideology, and we'll need to work with our partners to disrupt their external attacks. At the same time, we need to do the kind of work to prevent the extremism from catching on, helping our partners change their educational system, provide more economic opportunities. Here, the United States isn't the largest actor, the most important actor at all. We're not going to be the ones that's going to win the ideological battle for the heart of Islam, but we can do things to avoid making it more difficult for our partners, and we can assist our partners as necessary.
So let's keep going with with the issues here, Will. Next one on my list is the two-sided coin that is Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, right? One side of the coin being the reformer, the other side of the coin being the autocrat. How do you think about how the United States should approach Saudi Arabia?
We can't write off Saudi Arabia. Let's just say that at the upfront. We have interests. Just like there are a number of countries around the world where there are challenges to working with them. Turkey is another one. It'd be a mistake to write off any of these countries, and I include Saudi Arabia in that category. However, there are real challenges with Mohammed bin Salman. If I can take one step back, though, you know, right now Saudi Arabia, no matter who's running Saudi Arabia, they really have three existential threats, and I don't use the word existential lightly. The first threat is from a transition in leadership that is not yet finished. Saudi Arabia, like it or not, is a monarchy, and anybody who has watched Game of Thrones knows the particular dynamics that come into effect when a transition in the monarchy is not finished. And this is a particularly challenging transition as compared to other transitions that have happened in Saudi Arabia, because it's a transition to a new branch of the family. It's a transition to a new generation in the family. And it's a transition in the fundamental way of doing business in Saudi Arabia, from a very consultative, collaborative model to a more centralized model. That's the first existential challenge. Until that's complete, that will continue. The other challenge is the need for reform on virtually every aspect of Saudi society. This one, as you noted, Mohammed bin Salman has recognized in a way that none of his predecessors had. And that's a really good thing. It's a really challenging set of problems that they have economically, socially, politically, and so forth. The degree of reform that's needed. You know, when Franklin Roosevelt met with Mohammed bin Salman's grandfather, I think Saudi Arabia had about 3 million people. And now it has roughly 10 times that. Saudi Arabia is a rich country, but it's a country that has lots of poor people in it. And we've already talked about the challenges of having young men that are aimless. So there's a massive need for reform in Saudi Arabia. And the third one is Iran. If you're sitting in Riyadh, as compared to 20 years ago, you see Iran vastly expanding its placement and access and encircling you and trying to, whether it's in Iraq, in Syria, or in Yemen, and trying to build in Yemen the kind of threat against Saudi Arabia from the south that they've been able to build over the decades against Israel from its north. So these are really huge issues. And the person that has to deal with them, Mohammed bin Salman, is somebody who was not trained all his life to deal with these problems. And so what you saw, most Americans know the story of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That was a horrible crime. In the old line in War and Peace, it was worse than a crime. It was a mistake because it's really set Saudi Arabia back. But it was not isolated. It was the end of a year to a year and a half of poor, rash decision makings by Mohammed bin Salman on a series of issues, all of which there was kernels of real issues there. It wasn't like Mohammed bin Salman was inventing problems, but the way that he chose to deal with these problems made the individual problem worse. And one hopes that MBS, if he is able to move from crown prince to king, has learned from that experience, because we could all be living in a world where he's going to be the king for many decades to come, and our interests will remain there for quite a long time. And if he has not learned from that experience that he's had, then we're in for a very bad situation.
So, Will, we have only a few minutes left, and I have two more issues I want to cover, so let's try to do this quickly. The first is the Israeli-Palestinian issue. How do you think about that?
Sure. Let's go through the Israeli-Palestinian issue very quickly.
I know you can do this.
There is not a very high probability of a solution for the Israeli-Palestinian problem today. The only real solution, the only lasting solution, is a two-state solution. That's really clear to anybody who's looked at it, unless you want to imagine solutions that are really horrific. The challenge is that the circumstances are not set at the moment for those kinds of negotiations to continue. I suspect it's going to require generational change. You know, we've had three U.S. presidents in a row. Bill Clinton, Condi Rice under George W. Bush, and John Kerry under Barack Obama, who spent a wildly disproportionate amount of their time trying to get to a holistic solution to this problem, and all of which have failed. I don't think a fourth attempt is going to do any better in these circumstances. What can be done right now are smaller achievements. What can be done are limited agreements on individual topics that can alleviate some Palestinian misery. And I think actually over the long run, the Abraham Accords and growing ties, a warm peace between Israel and the Gulf, can actually help potentially set the stage for better negotiations when the circumstances are more opportune.
So you did it. Absolutely, you did it. So you've been great with your time, Will. Just one more question. What's the one piece of advice that you would give to President-elect Biden on the region?
Well, the one piece of advice is to really understand how much the perception of American withdrawal is affecting the region, and how much his personal relationships with leaders there will be able to impact their continued thinking on that subject.
Will, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real kind of education on the region, which I think is absolutely necessary at this time. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Will Wexler. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.